The Life Assurance Committee SEM Phase 2 subcommittee conducted a survey into the industry's treatment of short-term COVID provisions that a lot of insurers had set up in the calculation of SCR. We have David Kirk here today to tell us about the results of those survey. David Kirk is a principal with Milliman and leads their consulting business in Africa. He currently chairs the Life Assurance Committee SEM Phase 2 subcommittee, looking at ongoing developments of prudential regulations and providing guidance for actuaries to apply the regulations consistently and in line with good actuarial practice. David, thank you. Over to you.
Right. Good morning, everyone. I thought maybe I would just take a moment to also talk about why I'm talking about this. And maybe a small advertisement for the SAM Phase 2 subcommittee. We do a lot of interesting and, I think, fun work. We are responsible, whether you like it or not, for the LAC-DT information note a couple of years back, the fairly recent APN 113 on expenses, which I hope you are all aware of, and I understand that the PMB approved our information note on retrenchment risk just a couple of days ago. There's a lot of interesting stuff happening around the regulations, and there's, you know, certainly more volunteers are welcome. And we've got a long list of things that we look at. And one of those things a couple of years back was, no surprise, COVID, and how are we dealing with this from an SCR perspective. So we conducted this very, very short survey, and the results have been kind of floating around within the working group for a year and a half, trying to decide what we actually do with it. It was a very short little survey. I have a very small amount to tell you about. But I thought there were some interesting insights, both in terms of what different insurers and actuaries were doing, and the views on whether those are the same and consistent or not. So that's really the origin for this presentation. Now, many people raised short-term, so-called short-term provisions for COVID-19, focusing on mortality and persistency. Those of us who have significant retrenchment risk raised provisions for retrenchment risk, and the range of other concerns around the what is the IFRS number, what is the SAM number, and what is the SCR treatment. And both being involved at times in reviewing from an audit perspective and as a head of actual function and sometimes doing the work, trying to understand whether those views are consistent or not and what to do with differences of views became certainly a topic of interest. So what we wanted to get from the survey is a sense of the different methods and the range of different methods used for provisioning and maybe more importantly from my perspective on the capital or SCR treatment. We want to work out whether there was a need for additional guidance and perhaps a different question, whether we want additional guidance and see if we could conclude on some recommended treatment. So maybe a bit of a spoiler. We know we don't have a conclusion on a recommended treatment, but we'll see where we get to here. Now, the survey, we sent out to all practicing certificate holders. We had a fairly modest number of responses, so always, you know, safety warning, health warning, interpret these with caution. But although the answers are anonymous, we genuinely don't know who provided. I do tend to try to twist arms and make sure we do get reasonable representation from the insurers and some of the bank insurers and consultants. No surprise that everybody had mortality there. Persistency, about half of firms actually use changes in persistency assumptions to set the provisions. And although it's only about a quarter here of people put up retrenchment, that is basically everybody for whom retrenchment risk is a big concern. So if you were a bank insurer during a period, retrenchment was a big concern. And in fact, I think we mostly got the mortality provisions too low early on. And we mostly got the retrenchment provisions too high. Turned out those initial really crazy spikes didn't last quite as long as we might have feared. Okay, another piece coming out of it was how long we were considering these risks for. Most people were 3 years. One of the respondents literally had adjustments to all of their future years, and I'll touch on that a little bit later in terms of the method of determining those provisions, and others maybe at 1 or 2 years and so on. This is probably where things start to get a little bit interesting for me, that most insurers raise these provisions as a big manual adjustment. It was probably a calculation accident, it was just added on to the overall provisions. Some did a particularly sophisticated approach and actually allowed their full actuarial models to allow for temporary increases in the decrement rates just for a period of 1 or 2 or 3 years, and then ran that directly in their actuarial system as part of the actuarial valuation approach. And one respondent just made a weighted average adjustment to their long-term assumptions. So you're going to get, you know, I guess, most impact at time zero, maybe about right, but maybe some differences in terms of how the shocks look from one year to the next. Now, if you make the changes within your actuarial system, a lot of the stress tests that you would do for your SCR calculations will just follow because this happened as an automatic process. But as soon as there is a manual provision out on the side, you now need to make specific decisions and do specific calculations to make sure, are you going to stress this or not? And so there are decisions to be made, there are approximations to be made, but there are also things that can be forgotten and not thought through. So it was an intense time. We started to work remotely. There's a danger in these manual provisions, although I'm not recommending against them, just making us all aware of those dangers. You'll notice I'm not really talking about the size or the estimation for the provisions much. That really wasn't the focus of our discussion. And maybe Stephen and Carson will give us more detail on that after me. But in terms of the base mortality stress, pretty much everybody did include a mortality stress component for that, which kind of makes sense. The assumption is supposed to be best estimate. The FSIs require stress to that assumption. There's not much to interpret. And yes, I think we all recognize that those additional short-term mortality provisions were not certain. There was uncertain. It was fairly clear that there needs to be some sort of variability around them. But two questions came up for me. One is that some insurers took more conservative approaches than others. Nothing specifically wrong with that. Some insurers aligned the IFRS and their SAM numbers. Some had compulsory margins embedded in there and some didn't. But if you are having a prudent underlying assumption, the appetite to stress that further starts to diminish a little bit because now you're starting to add a margin on top of margins. But the other question is, well, the calibration of the standard formula, and Ron was telling us we may need to revisit that calibration in any case, but the calibration of the standard formula allowing for the sort of variability on a long-term basis from standard mortality, there's no particular reason to believe that that is the correct variation in our COVID provision with all the additional uncertainty around there. So even though we did need to allow for it, and everybody did, I think it's very clear to me that the base mortality stress probably didn't have much to do with the actual variability in those short-term COVID provisions. So we'd follow the process, but probably in an author perspective, there would need to be some sort of discussion around additional levels of uncertainty coming out of those positions, and arguably the standard formula isn't necessarily appropriate. But most of us agreed to apply the base mortality stress. When it comes to the catastrophe mortality stress, things were a lot more mixed. Some did literally add in that short-term COVID provision into their stresses and applied the mortality catastrophe stress to that on top of it. But nearly half didn't. Said, well, actually, hang on. We've had one pandemic. We're dealing with that. We've got the mortality cat stress on our base mortality, which already allows for another pandemic. Why would we need to add a catastrophe stress on top of an incredibly stressed existing position? And I think that is a reasonable view. It's obviously not as conservative as a view as the alternative. One question that raises itself is, well, if we think that there is still a 1 in 200 chance of another pandemic, do we think there's going to be no interaction between the impact of this new pandemic on the existing pandemic and impaired health and strained health systems? That feels maybe slightly optimistic, but again, a pandemic on a pandemic itself may be a little bit too much. Then I was also wondering whether there could be a parallel to the reasons we hold an equity symmetric adjustment. And to my mind, there are two reasons. Well, there's one good reason and one often said reason as well why we hold an equity symmetric adjustment. The bad reason, to my mind, is that after a significant market fall, we think the chance of a further fall is now much lower, and therefore we need to adjust the calibration to see if there's less risk. I don't believe that's particularly justified, and I don't believe that's why the equity symmetric adjustment was created. My understanding of why the equity symmetric adjustment was created is that once all insurers have had this balance sheet stress and their free surplus is under pressure, them needing to de-risk their balance sheet by selling into a falling market is probably not the best idea. So to manage the pro-cyclicality, that's why the equity symmetric adjustment is there. So I don't think the parallel necessarily holds, because I don't know that the probability of another pandemic is reduced. And also there's no systemic impact. There's no cyclical impact of insurers selling equities because of pandemics. Okay, then we're moving on to mass lapse. And I feel I need to explain the diagram. There are two reasons for this. The one is that when you search for pictures that you can use on lapse, you get time-lapse images as opposed to mass-lapse images. So yes, this is a mass-lapse image. But if you think about the reserve pattern for a level premium risk product, right, starting low or negative, moving up over time, I think that works quite nicely. And it does actually link into why we have mass lapse, these big negative liabilities that will disappear when somebody lapses. So there was about a 50-50 split between those that applied, were allowed for the COVID-19 short-term provisions in the mass lapse and those who didn't. But of course, unlike in the catastrophe component, here, allowing for the additional provisions that we have decreases the size of this negative liabilities and therefore decreases the mass lapse stress. So not allowing for it is in fact conservative. Allowing for it is probably perfectly reasonable. But there were also some approximate approaches done to how to calculate this, especially where you have this big, lumpy, extra COVID short-term provision with more or less mass, more or less size behind it, and a sense of comfort around an absolute number. Allocating that back to individual policies isn't necessarily straightforward. So it has to be part of your overall actuarial system. You have to actually allocate it back in some way. And many people said, well, actually, that's too complicated and maybe it's spurious, and they just offset the entire COVID short-term provision against mass lapse, which is probably okay if you had allocated it back equally. You actually would have still ended up with negative liabilities for each of those policies. But any individual policy would have moved from a negative to a positive. You actually wouldn't be able to take that full credit. So in this case, those approximations actually are probably not conservative. And again, I wonder to what extent all of that was necessarily thought through. On the level lapse front, not too much to say there. It really was pretty similar to what happened on the mass lapse front. Okay, so we asked the participants whether they thought there was consistency across the industry, and the answer was no. 0% of respondents thought that there was consistency across the industry. And I guess I'm happy because that meant all the respondents were correct. But then we asked, well, how many of you want guidance? And less than 2/3 of the respondents said they wanted guidance. Now, in my intro slide, I differentiate between need guidance and want guidance. And listen, I have been a little bit to blame or involved with issuing additional guidance. So I believe that guidance is helpful and useful and supports my work and allows me to make fewer decisions and have more confidence and so on. But I can understand that more and more and more guidance adding to all the pages of the FSI can be a bit of a pain. There were some thoughts on why maybe extra guidance wasn't necessary. And one of them was that, well, actually should already be able to justify their approaches against the principles set in guidance. I don't want to say whoever wrote this is wrong because they may well be in the room, but given that 0% of people said that we were consistent, and we can tell the wide range of responses, it's hard. I don't feel that the guidance was clear enough. I feel you could probably argue for and against the mortality catastrophe risk being in and out. And that's not a situation where that is left up to individual expert judgment, I don't believe. There's another comment that industry standard assumes that all have the same exposure and that it might be better to leave the decisions to the individual companies or actuaries. And I have a lot of sympathy for this view, right? We don't want to say this is the exact calculation that you must follow because your exposure, your products could be different. I don't think that's what I had in mind with the guidance. More than saying you must do exactly this. These are things that you should consider and whether you should be stressing or not, something like catastrophe risk. Then we had a very true statement. Different approaches are valid for different companies. I don't disagree with that in general. But then the follow-up, which I still feel is slightly optimistic. And remember, guys, I spent more than a decade working in audit firms. I love audit firms. But the idea that since the approaches are audited, the audits would catch any practices that aren't valid and would all be doing the same sort of thing, I think is a little optimistic, right? This is true always, but also in the scope of new short-term provisions, new ideas, different things, how we do this in a rapidly emerging environment. And individual audit firms, some of them will see a fairly large portion of the market, but not all of it. So what happens when industry practice gets less and less consistent and the practices get more and broader, auditors have to accept a broader set of practices as being acceptable and reasonable. So we don't necessarily get, at least in the short term, that coalescence and convergence to a single set of good ideas, or at least a reasonable set of good ideas. So really the question is, what did we learn? Estimating these things is not easy. That's not the point. That they're very, very difficult. And in fact, my own experience, the more sophisticated approaches didn't necessarily get much better results, at least beyond the current wave. So a lot of time and effort spent on trying to get these provisions right. And ultimately, there was a wide range of provisioning approaches. But that's kind of less problematic to me, because we all have different estimation methods for our reserves and provisions. But when it comes to SCR, it is a little more cut and dried, or at least it's supposed to be. There's a set of requirements you must follow, you must apply these shocks, you must apply the formula. I was happy to see that most of the approaches were intended to try to be conservative. I think we shouldn't lose our actuarial leanings towards conservatism entirely, particularly in situations with particular amounts of doubt and uncertainty. And there were very, very many approximations and a wide range of different approximations and different levels of rigor and kicking of the tires on them. And I worry a little bit that all those unintended consequences of a particular approach weren't necessarily thought through. To my mind, it is actually clear that the existing guidance is inadequate to have all got us doing the same sensible sort of thing. Whether we need to put out more guidance on this one particular topic, or whether we do wait for a more robust review of the regulations, I guess remains to be seen. And I think some misplaced reliance on the third line on external audit to make sure we're all doing the same sorts of things. Not least of all, even if auditors do have all the same consistent view, waiting up until that point does take some of the responsibility away from management. And then taking into account some of those qualitative comments, yes, we shouldn't be trying for overly prescriptive rules, because different approaches may be necessary in different scenarios. We do still want to be able to apply our common sense and understanding of our product and our business. So if there were to be any sort of new amount of guidance, certainly judgment would still be required. As I warned you up front, this was fairly short, and there's not much in the way of clear recommendations, but this will be kind of flowing through the SAM phase to subcommittee as we look at various items. So I guess watch the space to see what else comes out in the future. Thank you.
Thanks for that presentation. Two questions. Did these reserves, have they been released? And where you had a business with mortality and an annuity book, did they do it both ways?
So I think partly that's a broader question than from a specific survey, so I'll give my take. I think for the most part, the short-term provisions have been released, at least for mortality. I know some insurers have slightly adjusted their long-term mortality assumptions to be higher. I think more insurers are struggling, a little bit concerned on the morbidity front around what's going on there. Is that persistency, how big that's going to be? So the change over from short-term provisions to more permanent changes, that's for me been more the discussion of the last year even. Again, the survey is a year and a half old now. In terms of annuities, we didn't ask the specific question. One of those respondents did say that they adjusted longevity in their calculations, if they were the only one. My guess is that most people didn't want to take that potentially good news. And again, given that they do affect different books, one could be concerned here or there. I think for the most part, a more conservative approach was taken.
Thanks, David. My name is Melusi. I just want to find out the whole concept of long COVID. Is there some sort of view that's being expressed in terms of allowing for that, particularly as part of the long-term assumptions in the actuarial models? Thank you.
Thanks, Melusi. I suspect you may get more information from Stephen and Carson later on. So they can even give a view now if they want, or we can wait to hear. As I said to David, I haven't seen very explicit concerns around long COVID and mortality in South Africa. But when we talk about long COVID, I guess there are two possible different interpretations there. The one is a series of fairly specifically identifiable health impacts, which affected a tiny minority of people, can seemingly be quite severe. The other is there a permanent change in mortality more generally? So the first type, I haven't seen specific consideration, but the more broader consideration of, do we think there could be a permanent increase in mortality? I know that several insurers have tweaked their mortality bases permanently, and some reinsurers have said to their clients, yes, this is a permanent change. Whether that's to justify premium rate increases or not, I don't know, but there's certainly a view on that. But again, the morbidity is definitely the bigger concern that I've seen.
Are there any more questions? I don't see any online. Are there any more questions from the audience?
One of the questions is, if more guidance is provided, would you agree that it should be done through
a quiz process to allow ample time for consultation and refinement?
I will get to the answer to that, I promise. I think the SAM Phase 2 subcommittee has seen a very large range of differences of interpretation, differences of application, unclear items, and so on. In my own work, I've seen similar, and I've seen sort of errors and so on in the FSIs and the way the wording is put there, and unexpected differences between Solvency 2 and SAM. The PA, I understand, I'm sort of speaking not on their behalf, but whatever, they have indicated informally that, yes, they are aware of challenges as well that they've been dealing with on a case-by-case basis. And they have said that there is interest in a so-called omnibus review of effectively all the FSIs. The exact time or when that might start isn't clear. How long it would take isn't clear. It would probably involve some form of in-depth internal review by the PA, and hopefully, as the actuarial society, we can have a lot of input into that, and the SAM Phase 2 subcommittee can hopefully be a useful part of that. And it would also involve some level of public comments. So in answer to the question, changes to the FSIs will require public comment as a process, and they may or may not require specific quantification. If the actuarial society puts out guidance, that doesn't typically involve a quiz exercise, but it does go through a pretty robust process of ensuring that the technical details are things that we can support, and goes through a view through the Life Insurance Committee itself, does go out for a comment period, goes to the Professional Matters Board. So if the concern is that somebody will be, you know, putting a pen to paper and suddenly increasing someone's capital requirements significantly, no, certainly it's a very careful, considered process not to do that. And the actuarial society does not write regulations. So it is still only guidance to actuaries.
Okay. There's another question around IFRS 17. Do you think IFRS 17 will change the approach to short-term provisions going forward?
I think it'll probably complicate the process of setting them up and changing them, because as I think we probably all know by now, raising those provisions and then offsetting against CSMs makes life more difficult. So the idea of having a one big pot of, you know, X hundred million rand doesn't work. You have to be able to allocate it back to those groups in order to offset against the appropriate CSM. So, yes.
Nikki, is there another question? Okay, I think there's a question here in the front.
I just want to check your view on some insurers increasing their long-term mortality because of uncertainty around future pandemics, and the extent to which you think that makes sense, given isn't that the point of capital, and that's what we hold it for.
I'm a big fan of Enid. My kid's more a fan of Enid Blyton. But Enid is more familiarly known in Europe as events not in data. The idea being that if we're going to evaluate the last 5 years of data, it's most likely not going to contain the infrequent outliers. And if it does happen to include infrequent outliers, it's probably overstating it. So in trying to come up with a best estimate of future experience, a probably weighted mean, if we are basing ours on, you know, the last 5 years of reasonable data and the distribution are skewed, we are probably going to be understating the expected outgo. So if you have an analysis of surplus, your best estimate assumptions, to my mind, shouldn't actually be 50% positive and 50%, sorry, your variances shouldn't be 50% positive, 50% negative. They should probably be, I don't know, making up numbers, 55% positive. But then every now and again, we'll have one particularly bad year. So the idea of increasing long-term assumptions to reflect a unbiased best estimate, reflecting some possibility of future pandemic experience, I think is appropriate for a best estimate assumption. However, if you say, well, let's actually increase that to allow for, to get us to a much higher percentile, then I agree, that's the role of capital. But my understanding isn't that that's what's being done. It's trying to get to a true best estimate, allowing for that skewness in the data.
Okay, thanks again, David.